Welcome back to the podcast, a show all about pets, veterinary medicine, all things fuzzy wuzzy.
Creepy crawly.
I am Dr. Lauren, veterinarian, internal medicine specialist, animal lover.
And I'm a lover named David Epstein.
And this is my lover.
Yeah. Actor and voice actor and animal lover here to provide the non-science brain to the podcast. Speaking on behalf of the layman here.
The old regular person.
The old regular, yeah.
Regular people.
Non-medical man.
Well, we have, I think, a pretty popular show that's come to be, an Ask the Vet show today, where we
Lauren can show off how smart she is. I get to ask the questions that you, our faithful listeners and viewers, have sent in. So keep them coming, because we really do want to know what you're curious about. Because we've got an amazing expert to be able to answer those questions.
Oh, so. Wow. Thanks, babe. But I think before we get into me answering all the questions, you have to answer a question. And that is last week's trivia question.
It was a fun one.
It was.
What animal can only be found in a small area of Manhattan? The bulldog rat? The Manhattan ant? The little Italy cockroach? Or a band-tailed Soho pigeon?
What's well, the answer?
If you're around the Broadway medians at 63rd and 76th Streets in New York City, keep an eye out on the ground for crawling critters, and you might spot something rare. That is where the Manhattan ant can be found, an ant that only lives in one small area of the city. It's a relative of something called the cornfield ant, and it looks like it's from Europe, but it's been unable to be matched with any of the European species. So this is the only place known as of now where this particular species of ant exists.
In Manhattan.
In Manhattan, like very specifically.
I thought you made that one up.
Between 63rd and 76th off.
That's
Broadway.
Actually crazy.
Yeah.
I thought you made that one up. It was too, like, I was like, Manhattan ant.
That's the one, yeah.
It's
no.
A bougie ant living there.
Very
I wonder
nice.
How much they pay for rent.
Yeah. Well done.
All right. Let's get to those listener questions. I think that we have some good ones this week. So David's going to ask, I'm going to answer.
So first question came in from Meher Mann. What do you think about using CBD products in dogs?
Ooh, that's actually it's a very good question, a very big
hot
question.
Hot topic now.
Hot topic. Yeah, it'd actually be a good topic, I think, for like a whole episode to do. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you the gist of it right now. So CBD oil, CBD products are very popular in people, especially now that they've been legalized here in Canada and in some areas of the United States. And because of that, there's a lot of products that are now being marketed for pets. I think the biggest thing is to realize about this is that there is a huge opportunity for CBD in pets in terms of research to show where it may be beneficial and where it may not be. We have already started to develop some of that research. There's studies that have come out showing possible benefits of CBD, particularly for like discomfort, chronic pain, like orthopedic pain, neurologic pain. So there's definitely some evidence that's coming out, but it is in such early phases that I think right now, especially when I, you know, have patients coming in and the owners are like, oh, can I use CBD for that? Can I try CBD for this? Can I try CBD for that? And I'm just like, honestly, I have no freaking clue because we just don't have the research. So most of this is off label. The other thing to realize is that 99% of these products that are being marketed are just these companies making products for pets and just saying, here's a pet product, and slapping a pet label on it.
Right.
They don't go through the scrutiny of other medications like FDA or, you know, Canadian federal level testing to say, this is how much drug is in here. This is what it should be used for. This is the dosage. So it's just like anybody and their brother can, you know, make a CBD product and say that it's for
pets.
There's
a dog paw on it all of a sudden. It's
exactly.
For pets. Yeah.
So I think it can be a bit dangerous. And I've definitely seen, you know, patients who have come in and they actually look like they have THC intoxication because, you know, maybe it's not as pure as we thought it was. And so right now, I think as veterinarians in general, legally, we can't, there is no legal product that we can prescribe that contains CBD for pets. So if an owner wants to use it, I usually tell them what I just told you and say, look, there could be a benefit. We don't have enough evidence to say so right now. If you want to try it, you can, but it's kind of at your own risk and with products that are not certified or approved. So I think it's definitely, it can be a little bit of a slippery slope, but I definitely have seen anecdotally some pet parents take that responsibility and use it, and they find that it's helpful for, you know, their dogs who have chronic pain or dementia. I think there's going to be so much more research to come out, and I can guarantee that it's going to be something we use in the future with appropriate products. But right now, I still feel like, I don't know I don't know how much I can promote that as a veterinarian.
All right. Well, I think we can get into a deep dive into another episode soon, because that is definitely a topic that I'd love to learn more about.
Of course you would.
Changing gears. This comes from curious vet student, CatCow27. How was your journey to internal med? And do you find it worth it?
Cat Cow must be a yoga-loving vet student. So I guess, you know, internal medicine, I actually, so as I've talked about before, when you graduate from vet school, you are proficient. You can become a, you know, a veterinarian, a general practice veterinarian, or you can become a mixed animal vet or a large animal vet. You know, we come out proficient in that way. But if you do want to specialize, you know, you go on to do further studies just like in people. So I did an extra 5 years to become an internal medicine specialist. Now, when I initially graduated from vet school, I actually thought I wanted to do oncology, veterinary oncology. And I think it was because my mentor, I was very close to, and I really idolized her, to be honest. But then as soon as I kind of got into my internship, I realized I don't necessarily love oncology.
Yeah.
And what I realized is where the cases that I loved the most were these puzzles that you had to solve. You know, these cases that there were so many intricacies. It wasn't always like a slam dunk answer. And sometimes you actually, when you get the answer of what it is, it feels so freaking good. Like it's like a puzzle solving, a bit of a vet or pet detective kind of role.
Well, we were talking about your love of true crime. And I think in another world, you would have wanted to be the detective that's cracking the cases of these cold cases.
100%.
So you get to now do this as a veterinarian.
Exactly.
Which is
kinda cool. Like the Dr. House of veterinary medicine. Yes. I always kind of refer to it. But sometimes you don't get the answer. So it can be a bit frustrating for sure. I guess for me, in terms of the decision to actually specialize, I'm the type that would like to know a lot about one area than know, like, you know, a superficial level about multiple areas. Mm-hmm. And so I just know myself, I wanted to specialize. That's just my personality. I wanted to be someone that people would go to, but then again, I get patients coming into me and they're like, can you look at my dog's skin while I'm here? And I'm like, ugh, I don't do that. You need to see your family vet about that.
Right. So that said, you feel like in becoming more narrow with your focus, you've maybe lost some of the
100%. Yeah. There are certain things that I just like,
I don't touch that anymore.
Yeah. General vets are way better at than me. Just like, you know, your dad's a cardiologist. If you ask him a question about, you know,
the water that's been stuck in my ear for the last 5 days, which thankfully, I think
it's gone. But you know, you just don't know. But yes, I knew I wanted to specialize, and then I quickly realized as I exposed myself to different cases during my internship year that internal medicine was what I wanted to specialize in. And I do get to do a lot of also. I do like procedures too. I didn't always love surgery, but I do like the minimally invasive procedures. So I do like that internal medicine still allows you to do things like scoping and procedures. In addition to...
Well, I've seen you. You're not the best with blood. Let's be honest.
Okay. It's only since I've been pregnant.
Yeah.
All right. I'm good with dog blood. You should see me during a rhinoscopy where I have I'll send you the most recent picture. It looks like a scene from Dexter.
As if you're bragging to me right now. I love it. Okay. So we've got quite a few questions to get through.
Yeah. We'll save some. But.
So while we're speaking about blood... This comes from orange, yellow, green, blue, purple. What is the best way to clean a non-serious wound at home? Well, let's skip going to the vet. Can someone at home deal with their dog injuries.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, again, I'm not the expert on wounds. That's definitely not my area of expertise. But I think in general, wounds can be hard because sometimes a wound from the outside looks non-serious, but really it can be serious. So, you know, a dog park wound, for instance, you might just see a little puncture on the side of the, you know, the chest, but that puncture might have actually gone through the muscle layers and into the chest cavity. So I will say, I will start off answering that question by saying, it's really hard to assess the severity of a wound. And so sometimes you need to go see a veterinarian to know for sure if it is serious or not. It's always better to err on the side of caution. Now, if it's something simple, like, you know, your dog rubbed up against a twig and, you know, it has a little scratch, but it's not necessarily open, then probably the best thing you can do is clean with a bit of, you know, soap and water, an antibacterial soap like chlorhexidine that you can get from the drugstore, and just some warm water and a washcloth. You don't really want to be using all sorts of fancy things. I mean, we know hydrogen peroxide is not necessarily a great antiseptic. People like it because it bubbles,
but it feels great.
It's not actually a great way to clean wounds. And, you know, sometimes if it's something small, you can put a little bit of polysporin or like a topical antibiotic on it, but you want to make sure your pet's not going to be licking that off and ingesting a ton of it. So you have to make sure anything topically that you put on is safe. So, you know, again, we're talking about very minor things. If there's anything more questionable or something that's bleeding excessively, you should definitely take them to the veterinarian.
Great. From Vet Tech Mashup, have you talked about feline pancreatitis and the consensus statement on it?
I believe it's feline pancreatitis, but yes.
And that is why I can't even ask the questions.
So feline pancreatitis is inflammation of the pancreas. It's a very common disease of cats. It can present very acutely where a pet might be very, very sick, or it can present chronically, which is, you know, quite common. Now, I think that's a really big topic to hit on just a ask the vet question. Feline pancreatitis is a very nuanced disease, potentially multiple factors at play, different management strategies. But as he alluded to, there is new what we call consensus statements. So these are statements that the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine released. So that's my specialty college, that basically give guidelines for veterinarians on how to manage these cases. So I did attend at the conference this year. I did attend, it was like a 2.5-hour lecture where they presented the findings of that consensus statement. And I think it didn't present anything very new, I would say. It's the same principles, which is that for acute cases, we have to treat them with, you know, pain management, IV fluids, hospitalization, nutritional support. And for chronic cases, you know, it's more of managing acute flare-ups and trying to, you know, find appropriate diets and things like that. But there's no easy fix is basically the end result. And I think if you're a pet parent who wants to know more, ask your vet, or if you're a veterinarian listening, the consensus statement is a good place to start to know kind of what tools you can use.
Great. I know we've got a few more questions, but I think we should wrap it up.
Yeah, maybe let's see what's the best one we have left.
Yeah. So this is a question. Is there an annual test that is a must do for adult dogs?
Yeah, so I think that kind of brings us back to the whole, you know, adult, senior, geriatric dog, you know, kind of issues. And I find that I typically recommend doing annual blood work and urinalysis, so urine and blood testing, once the dog reaches that kind of senior age group.
And so for our listeners that missed our episode on senior and geriatric dogs, that 7 is the age?
Well, 7 is often a number. 7-8 is often a number people allude to, but I think it really depends on the patient and it depends on their breed. You know, a 7-year-old Great Dane, that might be the life expectancy of a Great Dane, whereas a 7-year-old Shih Tzu is maybe actually
12 and 13 years left.
They can live forever. So it really depends. But at some point, I do think, you know, doing annual blood work, even if your dog is or cat is acting completely healthy, mm-hmm. you know, there's a reason why we do annual wellness exams. It's not only to do a physical exam to look to see, you know, do have they developed things like dental disease? You know, what is their body condition? All those things that we try and get ahead of preventatively before they cause an issue, but also doing blood work and urine, because a lot of the time, you know, we detect things on blood and urine that they're not symptomatic for yet, but maybe detecting them when they aren't symptomatic is better than waiting till, you know,
too late.
So mm-hmm. I think a really common one is dogs go in for their annuals and they have dental disease. And so the vet recommends a dental cleaning and, you know, prophylaxis. And because those are done under general anesthesia, they do blood work. And blood work often will show, oh, this dog has elevated liver values. And then they get sent to me and we do a workup and maybe we find a mass, maybe we find something else. But if we had waited till that dog was symptomatic, we may not have the options we do. So I think, you know, as a pet parent, probably advocating and, you know, as a veterinarian, advocating for those annual tests, you know, once they're kind of middle to older is advised. I do blood work on, you know, my senior dog since he was about 7. I do annual blood work and always, always, always do urine with blood work. They are complementary. You cannot fully assess a patient without doing urine. So that is where I will leave my soapbox for these Ask the Vet questions today.
Which is fantastic, and it gives me an idea of what I'm going to be talking about in my trivia question that I will pose not to you but to the audience when we come back. We are back, and you're in luck because we've got a trivia question for you. And
does it have to do with urine?
What made you think that? Sure, it does. This one is for all y'all out there. Which animal washes their hands and feet in their own pee?
David Epstein.
Is it a capuchin, which is a type of monkey, a koala, lemur, or a possum? And that question goes out to all of you. Let's see who can get a P+.
Oh my God. You're already ready to be a dad to this baby. David's been making dad jokes since he came out of the womb.
I know, it's true. I'm excited now that I actually will have a reason to.
And on that note, I have to pee. So I think we will wrap this episode up. Great episode. Again, for the Ask the Vet, you know, reach out to us at any time. Let us know what you'd like to hear on the podcast. Let us know what questions you want answered. We are here for you. We always love your questions. They're always so original and, you know, keep them coming.
And with that said, do all the things that podcasts ask you to do. Like, subscribe. You can hear us on all the places where podcasts can be heard and on YouTube at Podcast TV. And with that said, I'm David.
I'm Dr. Lauren.
And this is the podcast. Ow!